Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1PLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today, CQ Magazine, for the month of July 2009. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. We'll begin today by looking at ham radio news. This commentary begins with a very good-looking picture of David Cowart, C-O-W-A-R-T. Dave's call is K-R-4-O-E, of Fayetteville, North Carolina. He's a grand prize winner of the CQ Golden Giveaway Sweepstakes. The prize was the winner's choice of an expense-paid trip or two to the 2010 Dayton Hamvention plus $2,500 dealer cash or a $5,000 cash prize. David chose a cash prize and says he's planning on putting it toward a new truck and HF mobile setup so he can activate rare counties while pursuing his own USACA All Counties / All CW Award. The complete list of winners was published in the June issue of CQ and is on our website. Congratulations to David and to all of the other winners. Scientists predict weakest sunspot cycle in 80 years. A panel of solar scientists assembled by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Space Weather Prediction Center is now predicting that solar cycle 24, which it says most likely began in December, will peak in May 2013 with an average daily sunspot count of 90. If the prediction is correct, this will be the weakest solar cycle since cycle 16, which peaked in 1928 at 78 sunspots per day, and the ninth weakest since records began being kept in the mid-18th century. The panel had initially predicted that cycle 24 would begin in March 2008 and peak in late 2011 or 2012, but the unusually long and deep solar minimum of recent months prompted the revised forecast. CQ propagation editor Tomas Hood and W7US will continue tracking the new cycle as it progresses. Claiborne, nominated to FCC. Mignon Claiborne, a longtime member of South Carolina's Public Service Commission, has been nominated by President Obama to the Federal Communications Commission. If confirmed by the Senate, Claiborne will complete the term of Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, who was appointed head of the Rural Utilities Service in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Claiborne, a former newspaper publisher, has served on her home state's utility regulatory board since 1998. She is the daughter of Representative James Claiborne, Democrat of South Carolina, a House Majority Whip. FCC resumes posting enforcement letters. The Federal Communications Commission Enforcement Bureau has once again begun posting copies of amateur radio-related enforcement letters. The site had remained unchanged since the retirement last July of Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH. The newly posted letters date back to this past February, when Laura Smith took over as special counsel for amateur radio. In the initial update, 29 letters were posted. 16 of them went to utilities companies in 11 states. All allegedly are causing power line interference to amateurs in their service areas and apparently have been unable or unwilling to resolve the problems directly with those affected. An additional 13 warning letters have been sent to individuals in 8 states. 7 of them are for overpowered CB transmissions that allegedly are interfering with hams on 10 meters, and 2 are for overpowered CB transmissions messing up the neighbor's home electronics. Another 2 are letters warning hams to stay off repeaters, whose trustees have said they are no longer welcome there. One warns a technician licensee not to operate in the general class HF bands, and another was for unlicensed operation on 2 meters. The enforcement letters are available for viewing at the FCC.gov website. Here's some more news about the FCC. They've released complete BPL studies. The FCC, responding to a Freedom of Information Act request from the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL, after virtually ignoring an order from U.S. Court of Appeals, has released the complete versions of the studies on which it relied in making its broadband over power line rules in 2004. According to the newsletter ARRL letter, the unredacted version of one study shows a conclusion that was just opposite of what the commission initially said it was. The key point in 3 studies examined to date was the question of whether BPL is a point source, meaning that the signal emanates only from the coupler between the power line and the internet. The FCC had argued that the study showed that BPL was indeed a point source, while these studies apparently showed no change in signal levels at a distance of more than 200 meters from the coupler along the power line. The ARRL says it will continue to analyze the newly released material. Well, if you're looking to get a vanity call sign, the fees may rise to $13.40. The FCC has released its annual proposed fee schedule. If adopted as proposed, the fee for a 10-year amateur vanity call would go up by $1.10 from $12.30 to $13.40. This fee must be paid on application for a vanity call and on renewal. The fee has varied each year since the vanity call program took effect 15 years ago, from a low of $11.70 to a high of $70. The final fee schedule will be adopted sometimes this summer. The new fees usually take effect on September 1 each year. And another FCC piece. My, we're bustling with FCC information. Here are we today. FCC clarifies vanity rules. A close relative of any, with emphasis, any, deceased former holder of an amateur call sign may apply for that call under the vanity program without waiting 2 years, according to the FCC, which issued the clarification to resolve a claim that the exception applied only to a relative of the most recent holder of a call, most recent in italics. The controversy began when Winfield Brantley of South Carolina got a new call and surrendered W3ZD. Just less than 2 years later, Alan Quarterman requested and received the call, stating that he was the son of the late Roy Quarterman, who had once held a call. The following month, Richard Essen, N6CX, petitioned the FCC to reconsider Quarterman's application, since Roy Quarterman had not been the most recent holder of W3CD. The commission denied Essen's petition, reaffirming that nothing in the rules limited the close relative exemption to the most recent holder of the call. So, Alan Quarterman gets to keep Whiskey 3 Zulu Delta. And we might as well continue with the FCC information. We don't always get this much in one publication of the magazine. House bill aims to reform FCC decision-making. Representative Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, has introduced a bill to try to keep the public better informed about the FCC's decision-making process. Barton is the ranking minority member of the House Energy and Commerce Commission, which oversees the FCC. Under his bill, H.R. 2183, the commission would be required to publish in advance the specific language of any regulations that it proposes to adopt, change, or delete, and subject those proposed changes to public comment before final adoption. In addition, it would have to ensure that each commissioner has adequate time to review a proposed decision before having to vote on it, and would have to establish deadlines for action on various categories of petitions and other filings seeking commission action. The bill would also require the FCC to publish a weekly summary of proposed decisions currently on circulation among the commissioners, and to publish the name of any commissioner who has not cast a vote within 60 days. The bill was referred to the Energy and Commerce Commission. Another bill before the committee, H.R. 2160, is an effort to get Congress to ban homeowner associations from completely prohibiting outdoor amateur radio antennas. I'll be reading more information about that by Rich Mawson when we go to Zero Bias, a CQ editorial, in a few moments. For those of you with Internet capabilities, additional and updated news is available on the Ham Radio News page of the CQ website at www.cq-amateur-radio.com. For breaking news stories plus information on additional items of interest, sign up for CQ's free online newsletter service. Just click on CQ Newsletter on the homepage of our website. Well, we just mentioned Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by editor Richard Mawson, W2VU. It's titled Antenna Restrictions and H.R. 2160. The quoting, Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enhancement Act of 2009, close quote, H.R. number 2160. Is a bill in the House of Representatives introduced at the request of ARRL by Texas Congresswoman Shirley Jackson Lee. The basic goal of this bill is to get the Department of Homeland Security to say that amateur radio is important for our country and to recommend that Congress make it illegal for private land use regulations prohibit outdoor amateur radio antennas. This is certainly a laudable goal, one with which we strongly agree. More specifically, the bill instructs the Secretary of Homeland Security to undertake a study on the uses and capabilities of amateur radio communications in emergencies and disaster relief, and to report its findings to Congress within 6 months. The bill also specifies that the study should include several specific recommendations, the major one of which is whether Congress should add outdoor amateur radio antennas to the section of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that currently prohibits private land use regulations, those are covenants, conditions, and restrictions, or CC&Rs, and home owner association rules, from barring the installation of outdoor TV antennas and dishes for receiving satellite TV. The ARRL has asked its members, and by extension all hams, to urge their representatives in Congress to support this bill. We join in this call, but do so with some reservations. Our support is qualified because, as worthy a goal as this bill aims to achieve, we believe the ARRL is going about the effort in the wrong way. There are several reasons behind our opinion. One, this is a steady bill. Generally speaking, steady bills are a waste of the government's time and the taxpayers' money because there is no requirement that Congress act on the recommendations it has requested. More often than not, steady bills result in reports being written, recommendations being made, and nothing ever really happening as a result. In addition, there is no guarantee that the recommendations made will be those that the bill's original supporters want. The ARRL's investment in political capital in the possible passage of this bill will result, at best, in the need to invest additional political capital in securing the introduction and passage of a follow-up bill to enact the recommended changes. At worst, we will have the Department of Homeland Security saying that its needs regarding amateur radio are met as things stand and that there is no need to make legislative changes. Two, the language of the bill provides answers in advance of some of the questions it asks to be studied. In the introductory findings section, the bill states that Congress finds the following, and goes on to detail the value of amateur radio communications in emergencies and disasters. If, by enacting this bill, Congress agrees to these findings, then why is it necessary to have a study to determine what Congress already has determined to be the case? Why not just go straight to a congressional finding that CC&Rs and HOA rules that prohibit outdoor ham antennas are unreasonable impediments to our providing emergency communications and propose the desired changes to the Telecommunications Act of 1999, or, better yet, direct the FCC to apply the limited federal preemption of PRB1 to private land use regulations as well as state and local laws. In parentheses, the FCC stated refusal to act in this area without a specific congressional mandate suggests it is prepared to do so if it has one. Close parenthesis. An action bill is a better use of resources than a steady bill whose answers are already known. 3. This bill, like other ARRL efforts in this area, is very tightly focused on amateur radio. It is, of course, the ARRL's job to protect and promote amateur radio in the United States. But the problem with CC&Rs and HOA restrictions extends far beyond ham radio and ham antennas. The much bigger, much broader problem here is that people who purchase homes in communities covered by these restrictions are forced to give up a host of individual rights. In many areas, these HOA-controlled communities are the only affordable, safe living option available and the only choice for a potential homebuyer in which of these neighborhoods to live in, not whether or not to live in one. The FCC has refused to get into these matters without a specific directive from Congress because it considers CC&Rs to be a matter of contract law. And the federal government has historically and correctly tried to avoid putting restrictions on what individuals and or companies can agree to in a contract. But this assumes that both parties to a contract are equal negotiating partners and that the terms of their contract are negotiable by both parties. In a vast majority of cases involving CC&Rs, however, this is not so. The developer, or HOA, has total leverage and a prospective buyer has none whatsoever, except to purchase elsewhere, and most likely still be subject to similar restrictions. Plus, in most cases, homeowner association boards are not accountable to anyone for their actions and are not subject to oversight by elected officials or state agencies, despite their ability to impose taxes, levy hefty fines, and even force you to give up your home. And as Lord Acton once famously said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. There is a growing resistance movement to the often unreasonable restrictions imposed by HOA rules and CC&Rs that extend far beyond amateur radio antennas. It would do the ARRL well, along with such efforts as H.R. 2160, to join forces with one or more of the groups that have formed to combat CC&R abuses and thus to speak with an even louder voice. The voices of these groups are beginning to be heard even within the Community Associations Institute, the trade organization representing HOAs. Preferring self-initiated change to restrictions imposed by government, the CAI has recently published a book for HOAs titled Reinventing the Rules, A Step-by-Step Guide for Being Reasonable. Perhaps this new reasonableness at CAI could provide an opening for the ARRL to work with the group on inserting reasonable rules regarding amateur radio antennas into the boilerplate regulations that the Institute provides for its member associations. At the moment, H.R. 2160 is the best option we have going for antenna restriction reform, so we encourage you to urge your representative to support it. But all avenues must be pursued, including working with other like-minded groups, trying to work with HOAs to find middle ground, and promoting legislation that is more than window dressing. And now Rich Mawson has one more comment about Dayton. I'm writing this just after returning home from the 2009 Dayton Hamvention. It was, as usual, semi-controlled chaos and a shot of ham radio adrenaline for anyone who attended. Our impression without having seen any numbers from the sponsors or even having time to fully assess our own numbers, is that attendance may have been up slightly from the past couple of years. There was lots of good stuff in the flea market. Even the city itself had more life than we've seen in recent years. The primary impact of the recession seems to have been that people were favoring smaller, less expensive radios and accessories over big-ticket items. Even so, that didn't stop one Japanese tower company from shipping in and displaying a huge motorized crank-up tower with an equally huge price tag of more than $50,000. As we've said in this space many times before, not too bad for a hobby that's supposedly a death's door, as it has been for at least the past 60 years. As always, a visit to Dayton in mid-May is, to steal a line from the popular books, chicken soup for the ham radio soul. 73, W2VU, Zero Bias by Rich Mawson. I have a few special event stations noted here in the magazine for July 2009. The call W0WIT from the 40th anniversary of the Winnebago Itasca Ham Travelers Club in Forest City, Illinois, will be July 18 and 19 on all the various frequencies folks are familiar with. Here's a good DX ZP15MWC. Zulu Papa 15, Mike Whiskey Charlie, from the 15th Mennonite World Conference, Asunción, Paraguay, July 12 through 19, various ham frequencies. You can QSL via PA0HEL, Papa Alpha Zero Hotel Echo Lima, or you can send via the Bureau. I have a few ham fests here, some of them in very early July I cannot give you, because today is July 1st, I believe, of 2009. Let's start with July 11th, Union City and Wattsburg Wireless Association, Green Township Municipal Building, Erie, Pennsylvania. Also on the 11th, South Milwaukee ARC Swap Fest at the American Legion Post, 434 Grounds, Oak Creek, Wisconsin. July the 18th, Slidell, Louisiana Hempfest in the City Auditorium, Slidell, Louisiana. On the 19th, Bratz Hempfest, B-R-A-T-S Hempfest, Howard County Fairgrounds, West Friendship, Maryland. July 24 and 25, Ham Holiday 2009, Moore Slant Norman South Penn Conference Center, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And on July 25th, Duell County ARC Hamfest. That's spelled D-E-U-E-L. Duell County ARC Hamfest. City Park, Clear Lake, South Dakota. Folks, while I was looking through the magazine for a few minutes before recording it today, I came across Beginner's Corner. The author here is Wayne Yoshida. Call KH6WZ. The article caught my attention. It's titled, Stretching the Ham Radio Budget with Used Classic Radios. I think this information, somewhat general and also specific in areas where necessary, may be very helpful to new ham operators or prospective operators in amateur radio and answer more than a few questions about used classic radios or just plain used amateur radio equipment. So let's begin. Hams worldwide generally are a creative and budget-conscious group. It is a ham radio tradition to use previous generation rigs, converted surplus radio gear, or home-built equipment to get on the air in an economical way. These days, the same is true, and budget-conscious hams have always figured out how to set up a station and enjoy using the airwaves. Recently, CQ Magazine editor Rich Mawson, W2VU, mentioned something about the demand for used rigs must be high due to the slump in the economy. As he wandered through the flea market, that's a swap meet, tag sale, or rally, depending on where you live, at the Orlando, Florida Hamcation, he noticed many old rigs for sale, including some very classic and once popular rigs that use vacuum tubes rather than transistors and integrated circuits. Vacuum tubes are sometimes referred to as hollow state technology, as opposed to transistors, which are solid state technology. Inspired by Rich's note, recently I went to one of my local ham radio swap meets and noticed the same thing. By the way, the Orlando Hamcation is one of the nation's best ham radio conventions. If you are planning a vacation near Orlando, you should arrange it to coincide with this excellent ham radio gathering. It happens every February, so it would also be a great place for a winter vacation. Used ham radio equipment can be found just about anywhere. Sources include your local radio club, ham radio conventions, and the internet auction sites such as eBay and others. Let's take a look at some of these classic and budget-stretching rigs with an idea of what to look for and things to watch out for when considering a purchase of old but good used gear. It would also be a smart idea to bring along an experienced ham friend with good radio knowledge so you can ask for his or her opinion. Besides, a good friend might also be a source for a short-term interest-free loan. One of the critical things to keep in mind while looking for bargain station equipment is your goal. You want something you can actually plug in and put on the air and not something that will just sit on a shelf for display. Just like looking for a reliable transportation car, you are looking for a reliable communication radio. In addition, you should look for a fully operational unit without any improvements or modifications. An operating manual, either the original or a copy, would be most helpful. Sometimes manuals are available to download from the manufacturer's website, or some helpful ham may be willing to provide a copy of the long-discontinued manual for a copying fee or something reasonable. Of course, too, you can use your favorite internet search engine to find a source for an operating manual for the old radio. While looking at used radios, remember that certain accessories may be needed in order to put the rig on the air, such as a power supply, or a microphone with a strange or non-standard connector, or some other detail like that. Make sure you ask if the set is a complete set, so you won't be disappointed later. When shopping at the swap meet, another good idea is to carry a big 12-volt battery with you, such as an automotive, a jump-start battery sold in hardware and auto parts stores. If you spot a radio that requires a 12-volt supply, you should ask the seller if he or she doesn't mind if you can power up the unit to see if it works. Remember to be sure to ask permission first. I have seen several series shoppers who carry or tow around in a car a small 110-volt generator around a swap meet. This is an excellent idea, and it will allow you to check EC mains equipment right there on the spot. Many new hams begin on the VHF for the UHF bands. This is generally true these days due to the increased interest in public service and homeland security organizations such as CERT, that's Community Emergency Response Team, RACES, which is Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, ARIS, Amateur Radio Emergency Service, and others. The VHF slant UHF bands are used extensively for such groups because of the local nature of this frequency band, and the radios are portable, either handheld, walkie-talkie units or whatever, and compact in car rigs, and the antennas are small. Operation on these bands is usually in the FM mode using simplex and repeater channels. These days, there are not too many old tube-type VHF-UHF radios available, although they do exist. However, aside from the unit being a collector's item or a curiosity piece, a VHF or UHF radio with tubes is not practical for beginners to use. However, mobile and portable VHF and UHF radios are usually in abundance, although some of these units look very nice. You must be certain what frequency or frequencies the units operate on. The HDs in Photo 1 and the mobile radios in Photo 2 are non-ham commercial two-way radios in the UHF public service band. The radios are programmable, fixed frequency channel rigs. Although it may be possible to modify and program these rigs to operate in the ham band, it would be best for beginners to ignore radios like this and find something more suitable for ham use, such as a handy talkie that is already modified for ham band use or an amateur radio specific unit. It is important to know that some old rigs from about the 1970s are not as desirable these days because of the limited frequency capability and the lack of frequency synthesizers, meaning crystal control or some other fixed channelized frequency scheme, such as the use of diode programming. For example, FM operations on the 2-meter band in the United States were once limited to 146 megahertz to 148 megahertz. While it is true that this frequency range may work perfectly fine in today's 2-meter FM band, a lot of band space is missing from these vintage radios. The current U.S. allocation for 2-meter FM spans from 144.1 megahertz to 148 megahertz. Take a close look at the frequency display on many 1970s and 1980s era VHF UHF FM rigs. Back then, mechanical dials and light-emitting diodes, LED, displays were used for a frequency readout. If you would like to use your radio outdoors in bright sunlight, the early LED displays cannot be seen. Mechanical dials may be off calibration and may not provide a good and accurate frequency display. Radios using crystals are okay to purchase, especially if the radio is in use in your local area. Since almost all VHF and UHF FM work is done on simplex and repeater frequencies, chances are pretty good that at least a few crystal channels will be usable without any changes. Might also be able to purchase new crystals for your favorite repeater system. Another thing that is important is what some manufacturers call a destination code on the radio, especially on the VHF and above bands. Frequency allocations may be different from one country to another, even though the model number may be the same. Usually there is a model number suffix that indicates the manufacturer's intended destination for selling the units. In addition to the frequency coverage issue, repeater access may be different in non-U.S. locations. For example, in Europe, repeater access is initiated by something called tone burst, which is a specific audio tone transmitted when you click the PTT, that's the push-to-talk button. In the United States and other locations, a sub-audible tone, CTCSS, is sometimes used for repeater access. The systems are not compatible. Perhaps the best VHF-UHF radios on the used gear market are like the unit shown in photo 3. That photo was on page 71 of CQ, and the caption reads, "Here is a good example of a used FM rig. This is a compact 2-meter slant 70-centimeter radio in working condition. The original power cord and mounting bracket are missing, but can easily be replaced. This rig has all the features of anything brand new, but it comes at a bargain price, and it works." This is an FM mobile radio that has been discontinued for several years. This unit is very compact and has a front panel that can be mounted remotely using an accessory cable and bracket. These radios feature frequency synthesizers, so there is no need to buy crystals to get on your favorite frequencies. And the frequency readout is a very readable liquid crystal display. For a ham looking for adventures in DX, which is long-distance communication contacts, the radios to look for are the larger units on the low bands, or the frequency bands that cover 30 megahertz and lower. On the front panel band switch, the rig will usually go from 160 or 80 meters to 10 meters. Some vintage rigs may include 11 meters, which is the citizen band. Don't even think about transmitting there with that old radio. Many used rigs are available for the low bands, ranging from the vintage and collectible, but also everyday and perfectly usable boat anchor radios, very large units that use tubes, to equipment only a few years old. One of the things I noticed at a recent radio swap meet was the great number of classic radios from the 1960s and 1970s. These units usually, but not always, have built-in power supplies and use hollow-state or tubes, rather than solid-state or transistor technology. Also within this era, the hybrid radio became popular and took the form of an all-solid-state receiver, and a transmitter with vacuum tubes in the driver and final amplifier section. And we'll finish up speaking of tubes. Recently, someone told me that tubes are hard to find. I'm not sure why my friend said this, since there is a very large ham radio swap meet every month in the area. Although some are tested and some are not, the price is right, about $1 each. If you decide to invest in radio gear that uses tubes, it is a very good idea to find a good tube tester or make a friend who owns one. Buying a used radio is a great way to stretch the ham radio budget, and putting an old classic radio on the air is a tried-and-true ham radio tradition. In fact, I was so inspired by this idea that I bought a pair of vintage Heathkit transceivers. I will be restoring these units and hope to get at least one of them on the air soon. It's signed 73, Wayne, call KH6WZ. Folks, this month's issue of CQ for July 2009 has the results of the 2009 CQ WPX RTTY contest. All that information is located on pages 20 and beyond. I'll give you just a bit of the introductory commentary by Ed Munns. Ed spells his last name M-U-N-S. His call is W0YK. Celebrating the 15th anniversary of the CQ WPX RTTY contest. A record number of diddlers turned out to thumb their nose at quiet old Saul and work together to once again break participation and performance records. Submitted logs rose another 11% to break 2,000 for the first time and set a new record high of entrants for this contest. The real heroes of this and many contests are the thousands of casual and not-so-serious participants who get on the air and hand out contracts to fill the logs of the more visible call signs documented in this article. While a vast majority of the operations submitting logs fall into this army of visible RTTY enthusiasts, there were several times more participants who got into our logs but didn't submit their own logs. 15,950 different call signs were logged, up 17% from 2008. Despite this impressive growth in participation, total QSOs only increased 7.5% over 2008 to 825,000. Given the lack of sunspots, this is actually an impressive statistic. Moreover, at this prolonged solar activity minimum, several of the 10 world records were broken. Another factor contributing to this is the double point value of contacts on 40 and 80 meters. This effectively made WPX RTTY a low band contest, especially for single ops. The savvy operators spent most of their 30 hours both nights on 40 and 80 meters. When 15 and 10 meters come back strong and the high band rates return, the low band bias should balance out. I see a very interesting article titled Update from Saudi Arabia, Reciprocal Licensing Okay, Famed Club Station Permanently Closed. The author here is Dave Kaiser, call AL7HG, Alpha Lima 7 Hotel Golf. We don't hear too much too often about ham radio in Saudi Arabia. Their prefix is HZ, Hotel Zulu. But some changes over the past 5 years are remaking the face of our hobby there. The bad news is that many hams' first Saudi contact over the years, the U.S. military training mission club station called HZ-1AB, active in Duran since 1947, has been disbanded and its call sign has been reassigned. The good news is that the Saudi government has authorized reciprocal licensing for foreign hams, making it more likely for hams around the world to have a chance to work the desert nation. Now, the article goes on to profile one expatriate ham currently operating in Saudi Arabia, and it looks at the history of club station HZ-1AB, as well as the author's own experiences there before the days of reciprocal licensing. The article goes on in great length about Kenneth G. Dyer, call HZ1GW, an expatriate from Wales with the home call sign of Golf Whiskey Zero Romeo Hotel Charlie, as one of the first foreigners licensed under the reciprocal licensing rules. It's a great piece about the gentleman And he certainly has super-duper looking equipment, the very high-end stuff, plus a great setup for mobile operation. But I want to give you a little bit of information about the actual history of that station mentioned before, HZ1AB. For nearly half a century, Hotel Zulu 1 Alpha Bravo was often the first worked and confirmed Saudi Arabian contact for DX enthusiasts around the world, including the first Hotel Zulu satellite contacts for hundreds of Oscar users. In contest, HZ1AB provided competitors with HZ and Zone 21 on all bands and modes. The station went on the air in early 1947. From then until it shut down permanently in 2004, hundreds of thousands of contacts were logged by more than 160 operators. HZ1AB's license was issued by royal decree from the king in 1946, with the license maintained by the U.S. military training mission. According to Bob Walsh, called WA8OMA, the July 1949 issue of QST showed a photo of W8FZL, and several others, standing with an HZ1AB call. The station back then was Harvey Wells' 160 through 10-meter transmitter and a Halicrafter BC610 and Halicrafter SX28. Kenneth Riley, KE5TS, who obtained his ham license in 1938, is believed to have been the first active HZ1AB operator. Riley worked for the Army Airways Communication Services and installed very high-powered radio transmitters in dozens of international locations. Riley said 10-meter conditions and time dictated what he could hear. He usually fired up around 4 p.m. and found stations from Europe and the United States East Coast solid across the band for 2 or 3 hours of operation. Now, I'm paraphrasing here. After each ZQ, Riley would advise stations to start calling from the low end of the band and sign their calls very often, while he listened and turned up frequency for a very short time, writing down the station's calling and at some point breaking in with transmission and reading off about 10 or 15 stations, and then calling off, in order, the stations and brief exchange reports and general QSO information. Riley said he used to flabbergast him to have what he considered to be some of the rarest DX stations in the world ask for a QSL card from HZ1AB. Between 1950 and 1952, the station was inactive. During the 60s and 70s, the club was called the Dahran Experimental Radio Association. The first meeting of Dahran Amateur Radio Club was held in June 9th of 1980. In 82, the club installed a 40-meter antenna and a KT-34XA, which was set up and used for CQ worldwide on both single sideband and CW. The author continues to give a lot of information about various years of activity, with whom and by whom, club logs and things of that nature. But HZ1AB was taken down on May 7, 2004, after 57 years in operation. Now, a few moments ago, I talked about CQ making announcements, and here's another one for the July 2009 issue. 2009 inductees for the CQ Amateur Radio Contest and DX Halls of Fame. CQ is proud to regularly honor the most accomplished members of the amateur radio community through 3 Hall of Fame, the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame, the CQ Contest Hall of Fame, and the CQDX Hall of Fame. We are pleased to introduce you to this year's inductees. And there is a very long list of well-qualified individuals. Our 9th annual class of conductees to the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame includes 15 individuals in one or both of the following 2 categories. 1, those individuals, whether licensed hams or not, who have made significant contributions to amateur radio, and 2, those amateurs who have made significant contributions either to amateur radio, to their professional careers, or to some other aspect of life on our planet. This year, we have a few non-hams among the group. Please note that in the cases of honorees who are silent keys, or deceased, or who are no longer licensed hams, call signs are as issued to them when they were alive or active and may have been reissued under the Vanity call sign program. if you as a listener are interested in these individuals and a short background on each one, from wherever they come from throughout the world, you can look at the July 2009 issue of CQ Magazine on pages 28 and 30. Page 29 happens to be a commercial page. As I move through the magazine, I see there's a very nice page here in full color announcing the Huntsville Hamfest, an AWR Alabama section convention. It's August 15 and 16, 2009. It'll be held at the Von Braun Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Here's a short piece you might enjoy about young people and amateur radio. The Orange County Radio Association, from North Carolina's Orange County and its surrounding area, was recognized in April by the staff of the Eflin Cheeks Elementary School in Eflin, North Carolina, for the technical support it provided the school in the installation of weather equipment. Kristen Bedell, called K-I-4-L-L-O, a radio amateur and teacher at the school, obtained a grant from Piedmont Electric Membership Corporation to purchase a weather fax receiver and weather station, along with a rooftop tower to mount the weather station sensor array and the weather fax receiver's antenna. About a dozen members of OCRA made several field trips to the school over a period of a month to assist with installation. On April 13, the station, located in the school media center, was dedicated with a special assembly of the students, along with invited guests representing OCRA, Piedmont EMC, and the Orange County School System's Maintenance Department. During the special assembly, everyone present was able to experience the acquisition by the WeatherFax receiver of a passing weather satellite and reception of its weather pictures. All the equipment worked as intended, and the school is looking forward to using this station as a teaching tool. Pictured with this piece is Kristen Bedell, call K-I-4-L-L-O, academically intellectually gifted teacher at Eflin Cheeks Elementary, where she's demonstrating the weather station to students at the school. The photo is courtesy of Woody Woodward, call K-3-V-S-A, along with the information. We thank Woody for that. I've come across a piece here titled, Filing Applications Using the FCC's Universal Licensing System. It's in Washington Readout by author Frederick O. Maia, M-A-I-A. Fred's call is W-5-Y-I. Just what do all these online screens mean, and how can I best use them? Judging by the mail and phone calls we get, there is a lot of confusion and misinformation about the FCC's Online Amateur Service Database, that's the Universal Licensing System, and how it all works. This month, let's talk about what you should know to more fully use the information that the FCC has available online. First of all, there are a lot of ham radio license databases on the World Wide Web. Some are better than others. But the one that really counts, and the one that you should primarily be using, is the one posted by the Federal Communications Commission. For one thing, it is the first information available. All other databases must download and post the FCC's version. You can get to the FCC's Amateur Radio Service Database by going to the ULS homepage at http://wireless.fcc.gov/ULS/. All of the various features of the FCC's Universal Licenses System branch from this web page. Every radio amateur should have this page bookmarked on his or her computer. Now, if you have any familiarity whatsoever with the Universal Licensing System and the FCC's page, you probably already know that there is a great deal of technicality to trying to figure out where to put the answers to various questions or remarks, so you have to look at it very, very closely. If you're a person that's interested in becoming an amateur radio operator, my suggestion is that you work with a qualified ham, a sighted person if you're print impaired, and get the thing right the first time. Boy, you could get into a lot of frustration. Now, the author of Washington Readout, Fred Maia, goes on for about 5 pages in the July CQ magazine. So, as you can tell, there's a lot of stuff to think about. It really should be an easy thing to accomplish, but it doesn't always work out that way. Well, here's one that caught my eye, Magic in the Sky, by Jeff Reinhardt, AA6JR, Putting Electrons in Motion. So, you've been talking on the radio, or working some CW, maybe even doing some PSK or ATV. The joy of what we do with SAM radio operators comes from conveying information that rides electromagnetic waves across the great open spaces. So far, so good. In past columns, we've explored many different facets of magic, some historical, some personal, but always tied to the wonder that makes radio communications one of the true miracles arising from the discoveries and creativity found in the human mind. What makes it all possible is the lowly, abundant, tiny particle we know as the electron. Too numerous to count, still not fully understood, yet willing to service on a moment's notice. Every day we send torrents of electrons on missions that range from life-saving to frivolous, lighting our homes, sparking our engines, racing through microchips, or just sitting in wait for our next command. We take electrons for granted, yet think of what our lives would be like without the ability to exert our authority over these humble servants. When electrons move, well, stuff happens. Have you ever considered where and how we set those electrons in motion? Sure, there's some natural movement, but we're talking serious energy here. Recently, your humble correspondent had the privilege of taking a behind-the-scenes tour at one of the prime electron shipping sites to be found anywhere, Hoover Dam, at the Arizona-Nevada border on the Colorado River. Since that horrible day in September 2001, the generating galleries of Hoover Dam have been a restricted access area. Having obtained advance permission, we set off on a journey into controlled access areas. A lengthy elevator ride from the top of the dam brought us down into the concrete and rock netherworld, now sadly seen by few. Exiting the elevator, we were guided to a bin where the required hard hats lay in wait. Finding one and sizing it, we were ready to proceed through a rock tunnel carved out by sweat-driven hammers, hardened steel, and powerful blasts. Long after man is extinct, these caverns will remain as a tribute to the dedicated workers who came from across America to work in oppressive conditions, people willing to lay it all on the line, yet glad to have a job in the depths of the Great Depression. Our guide told us of the bypass tunnels that were cut and blasted from the canyon walls that allowed the untamed Colorado River to pass around the dam's construction site. A cofferdam upstream forced the water into the tunnels, allowing workers to first dig down to bedrock and then begin pouring concrete. Far above, high scalers cleared boulders and other hazards from the canyon walls. Dangling from ropes and cables, they were a heartbeat away from eternity every moment they were on the job. Think for a moment of the many technological tools we have at our disposal. Through computer programs and calculators, we can land spacecraft on Mars. Hoover Dam was designed and built in an analog age, where high tech was delivered through a slide rule. Further into our journey, we burst from the tunnel into an amazing open area, the generator gallery on the Nevada side of the dam. The beautiful and durable terrazzo floor looks like it was installed last week. I wanted to linger and explore, but we were escorted farther and challenged to keep up with our guide. We soon emerged outdoors, walking across the lower face of the dam. I stared up at the imposing height of the structure, wondering how many hundreds of billions of gallons of water were exerting their weight against the concrete above me. Walking a little farther, we came to the state line painted in the walkway at the center of the dam. With just a few moments to take some photos, we resumed walking and entered the Arizona side of the dam and into the generator gallery. An unexpected first stop was at a mini generator, a water wheel device that provides power for the dam complex itself. However, nearby lurk the giants, the huge enclosed rotors driven by mighty turbines, taking the full force of voluminous water driven by some 500 feet of head, delivered incredible pressure to spin the turbine's blades. I stopped to admire the beauty and simplicity of the basic design. A gallon of water weighs 8.345 pounds. Its force can be channeled and amplified by dropping it, and I was reminded of an engineer friend's mantra, gravity always works. Despite my amazement, the generators quietly went about their work, revolving at 180 RPM, delivering 60 cycle current perfectly synchronized with the other units to locations throughout the West. Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Tucson. It was easy to speak in controversial tones. The balanced units churn out their energy without a fuss. A single unit generates energy at the rate of 115,000 horsepower, or 133 megawatts, and I was standing among a row of similar machines. My mind swung to imagine some of the uses of that power, that moment, from light bulbs to a person impatiently selecting the floor of an elevator button to a life-sustaining device at a hospital, maybe even a ham radio operator about to key down. It was incredible to think that I was standing next to the source of that power. Additional stops on the tour took us to a room where we stood above a 30-foot diameter pole that delivers torrents of water to each generator. The little rumble is just a hint of the forces in motion. Another trip through the generator gallery and down some stairs took us to a very rare look at the links between the turbines and the generators. It's a noisy room that conveys the serious work being done. Once again, we ascended to daylight where we looked up at the dam and at the water exiting the turbines to resume its trip down the Colorado River pathway. It's quite likely the lamp you may be using to read this story is driven by a generator, electromechanical motion being used to send electrons on their many diverse missions. I hope you've enjoyed this glimpse into the origins of how some of that power begins its journey, awaiting your command to key down and create some magic in the sky. That commentary was by Jeff Reinhardt, Alpha Alpha 6, Juliet Romeo, in Magic in the Sky, Putting Electrons in Motion. Now, Jeff concluded quite a few beautiful full-color photographs with this article. And I have to tell you in closing today, folks, that I've been privileged over the years to visit this very site, and it sounds to me as though I had one of those earlier versions of the tours when hundreds of thousands of people from around the world came as sheer tourists and were given full access to this facility that this gentleman is referring to as virtually a closed environment now. And so it goes in this world. And he was right. Everything he said was right on. What a sight to experience if you've had the opportunity. I'm sure those of you that have had it are agreeing with me. This brings me to the conclusion of this CQ Digest reading of CQ Magazine here on the Courage Handy Ham System. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The recordings are production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handy Ham is always one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, at courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH is in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right on Buzzards Bay, on the way to good old Cape Cod. So if you're going by this summer on Interstate 195 and you get to Exit 12, just sort of wave at me and say, hi, Bob. It's always a pleasure to read for the Courage Handy Ham community. I thank you for your time. And, you know, I must apologize again. It seems I always do that at the end of these recordings for the raspiness of my voice. But it's the toll that life and age takes upon an individual when they're doing a lot of recording or speaking with a voice, which I've been really privileged to do for many, many years in different areas. Thanks a lot for listening, and if you'd like to contact me, I'd be delighted to hear from you on email. It's my call sign, n1blf@comcast.net. 7388, and have a great summer season.